funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we eat the way we do, and how have our national tastes evolved along with our culture, agriculture, and technology? My guest this hour is food historian Andrew F. Smith. His newest book traces America's adventures in eating from the rise of vegetarianism to the dawn of our calorie obsession to the accidental invention of the microwave oven. Along the way, it offers an interesting lens through which to view the quirks of our culture even beyond mealtimes. Andrew F. Smith teaches food studies at the New School University in New York. His latest book is called Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Andrew, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris.
One of the first big technological advances in the way we eat came with the invention of the automated flour mill. I guess, among other things, it transformed bread as we knew it.
It did. It transformed the milling industry and at the same time transforming bread. But it really starts off as a family enterprise that really hadn't changed in hundreds of years from the milling industry. And there may be 50,000 mills in early America. Of which virtually every community had one or more. And due to the inventions of Oliver Evans, who automated the milling industry, going from maybe needing four or five people operating a mill to none, it very quickly changed the idea of how you construct mills and the output of the mills. So the result was that you had the beginning of continuous processing, which is the basis for all industrial food.
And remarkably, Evans hadn't really done anything with milling until he set about trying to change this ancient technology.
No, he was a tinkerer. I mean, he just looked at things and said, well, I could do better than that, which was part of American spirit in the late 18th century. And I think he was among many people who were looking at things and say, there's a better way to do it, and here's how you do it. He was one of the first people to actually get a patent on his processes. And while the processes that he devised were incorporated into existing mills, where it really made a difference was where they started to construct new mills, some of which were five stories high and produced 50 times the amount of flour that the unautomated mill could do.
So this was efficient and it was cheap, but it also took a lot of the fiber out of our diets.
It did. Eventually, it took all the fiber out of the diet, and in addition to that, it made much finer flour, which was good for bakers because it was took less time to bake, and it took the nutrition out. So those are the things that I don't think Evans or anybody else put in the inventions knew anything about, but those were the ultimate results.
Now, restaurants, of course, play a huge part in what we eat and how we eat today. And in some ways, this place, Delmonico's, kicked off the revolution. Will you tell us about it?
Well, there were some restaurants in America prior to Delmonico's, but essentially Delmonico's, two Swiss brothers decided they were going to open up a restaurant, which really starts as a pastry shop and then proceeds forward. They had no experience running restaurants, and one of the brothers was a captain on a ship that used to be engaged in trade with New York, and they decided that it was about time that New York had a French-style restaurant. So they created America's first French-style restaurant, and it was, for almost all of the 19th century, it was the model that virtually every other restaurant followed, and it's the main introduction of French food into American food.
So the way Delmonico's did things became the way people thought a restaurant should do things.
Right. So they started, their early menus were all in French, no English translations on some of them, and Americans decided we need to have French menus in our restaurants too. So there was this whole French craze that went throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. And with French food being parts of it. Oftentimes the French was misspelled and mangled, but that's another story.
That's an American thing, too, I guess. Now, let's talk about food shopping, because when most of us think about it today, our minds go instantly to the local supermarket.
Yep.
Talk first about how people shop for food before supermarkets existed.
Well, prior to the time that you even had grocery stores, that would have been the farmers markets that we know and love today. So in one sense, the farmers markets are throwbacks to the way things were in part 200 years ago. And so as cities grew larger, the farmers markets couldn't serve all of the communities, and you had specialty stores that would open up, one of which was the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. And from that, A&P emerged, and A&P was the first large chain grocery store in America, and it caused quite a bit of anger among large numbers of people who were otherwise selling at farmers markets and things of that sort, but they began to dominate the American scene. And these relatively small stores by today's standards would only have several hundred items for sale, emerged in the late 1920s, early 1930s as the supermarket that we know and love, which today may have as many as 100,000 products.
You know, what's really interesting, Andrew, is thinking about the fact that self-serve food shopping was, in its time, revolutionary.
It's a it was an invention. I was surprised. I mean, there were so many things. I loved writing this book. I want to state that to begin with. And there are lots of things that I should have known but didn't until I started getting into the research behind it. But all of the early grocery stores, you would walk in with your list, or you would send somebody to the store with a list, and it would be the clerk who would go and pull the items off the shelf and package them and then give them to either the person who's actually doing the buying or somebody that the person would send. And that really didn't begin to change until the early 20th century, when you had self-service, and people were very upset with self-service, which today I can't imagine doing it any other way, with particularly with the large number of products that we have available in supermarkets. But that's an invention. It was a great creation, and it was heralded as such when it came out.
And people may remember the Alpha Beta grocery stores. They were called that because initially all these people who were so upset at having to pull their own groceries had the stores alphabetized so that they could figure out how to find things.
That's exactly right. How would you know where a product was? And the answer is they had all of the shelving space organized alphabetically. I thought that was great.
And the other thing that was happening around this same time was that middle-class Americans started to own cars so that we could travel longer distances to shop. We could buy more in one visit. It wasn't about getting things for tonight's dinner and tomorrow's breakfast. It was about shopping for a week or two.
Right. Historically, Americans would have shopped almost every single day, either on your way home from work, or if you weren't working, you would go to the store and pick up whatever would be needed in the next day or so. But typically, you would have bought your bread at a bakery, you would have bought your meat at a butcher, you would have bought other goods perhaps in other stores, so that you'd have several different places that you would have visited. And that shopping took a good deal of time, but you could only shop as much as you could carry. So when automobiles came in, it was possible to shop for an entire week or an entire month. And you could just drive your car to a supermarket, as long as the supermarket had a parking area, and you could buy whatever you needed, put it into the car, and take all the goods home. So it made a huge difference in terms of the way Americans acquired food and also the types of foods that we would eat.
I think what I loved most about this chapter was that it made me think about the fact that supermarkets have a huge sort of curatorial role in what we eat. If we don't find it in the market, especially in years past, it just wouldn't really enter our consciousness in terms of what was out there.
That's correct. The supermarkets have certainly been the gatekeepers to products, and today it's very difficult to get a new product on the market. If you're a private inventor, if you're a large corporation, it's different. You already have relationships with buyers in supermarkets and things of that sort. But, it does control exactly what is available for most people who buy most of their food in supermarkets.
And early on especially, this had a huge impact on the kind of produce that we ate, because these markets that were hanging on to food for days and weeks at a time wanted fruit that wouldn't bruise easily and things that wouldn't spoil quickly, and that had a lot to do with what we ate that was fresh.
Correct. Historically, a grocery store would have acquired their products from local farmers, and they would have had whatever varieties that were available locally would be what would have gone into a grocery store. But with the supermarkets, they buy nationally. They buy wherever the cheapest apple is, and whatever that includes cost of transportation in terms of how they calculate it. But they would want products that could be transported a great distance to a large number of different supermarkets. So it's the buying process that supermarkets go into that creates the type of products that are currently available in those supermarkets.
And then we saw the rise of convenience stores, and certainly most people aren't buying their entire week's worth of food there, but how do they affect the way supermarkets do business?
Well, the problem with the supermarkets is that they're too big. And if you only want to buy one or two products, you really don't want to spend the long time that it would take to find the product if you don't know the supermarket, and then check out if there's a long line. That's a problem. So convenience stores, which really began to they existed prior to the 1970s, but that's when they began to become popular. If you just want some milk or you just want something relatively easy to get that a convenience store would have, that made a big change in terms of the types of shopping that people would do. So you didn't have to wait in line. You didn't have to look around a lot for the products. And for supermarkets, what that meant was there were certain types of products that you put in certain locations in the supermarket so that they were either easy for people to get or they were difficult for people to get, and you had to walk a great distance. So, for instance, milk in a supermarket is frequently in the back corner, and the reason is everybody needs milk. You have to go back there, and as you go by, you see all the other products that are there. And impulse buying is a big part of what Americans do.
So a gallon of milk ends up costing $28.
Yeah, that's what happens to me every time I go. I didn't even know I needed those products until I saw them in the supermarket.
Andrew F. Smith is with us. He's a food historian, professor of food studies at New School University. His new book is called Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. We'll resume our conversation with Andrew in just a moment. If you would like to receive a copy of his book, Eating History, Jeff Whittington, senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, is here to tell us how you can do that. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much for tuning in today. You can get your very own copy of this fascinating book when you join the station at 800-456-5372 or via the web at kera.org. You can get your very own copy when you join at the $120 membership level today. That's just $10 a month if you use the KERA Sustaining Membership Program to support the station. However you decide to do it, though, and I will say this, it looks like about 94% of our contributions are coming in on credit card, which is great because the dollars go to work right away for the station, and we don't have to send you any kind of reminder or anything. It's very easy to do. So just grab your credit card, call us 800-456-5372, or do it online. Just do it today.
And debit cards work as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You know, today's show is the kind that Jeff and I really like to do, and we know that you like it too, because it makes you, you know, as the name of the show would imply, think about things that otherwise sort of pass right by, and you sort of stop and understand the connections and the relationships between things. I don't know if we'll get into talking about this with Andrew, but cool piece of trivia. The microwave oven was invented after this guy working on military applications with microwaves had a candy bar in his pocket and noticed that it kept melting when he was working and standing in front of these things. And he thought to himself, what is going on here? Which is sort of terrifying if you consider the ramifications of that. But now we can all have a baked potato in 3 minutes. So
that's right. I mean, you know, better living through military and
the military
industrial science.
Complex.
That's
yes.
Right. So, at least they didn't do it in space. You know, I mean, so many things came from space, too. I mean, where would we be without dehydrated ice cream?
And Tang.
Exactly. So this is the kind of show, as Chris said, that we love to do. And Andrew Smith is one of our perennial favorite guests. And we're thrilled to have him today. How about you? Call us, 800-456-5372. Let us know by contributing online at kera.org.
If you want to get a copy of Andrew's book, Eating History, we have it available for you at the $120 contribution level. Now, we can do this whether you make a credit card or debit card contribution, or we can also make it happen if you join us as a sustaining member. That's all easy to set up when you call right now. The volunteer will be able to give you the details. The telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. Of course, you can also go online and check out all the thank you gifts.
Yeah, it's really easy online. It takes about 90 seconds for you to become a member, maybe a little longer if you want to shop through the thank you gifts and some of the books we've had on the show. But just do it today because it really means a lot when you join earlier in the drive. So please, 800-456-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andrew F. Smith, who is professor of food studies at New School University. His new book is called Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. If you would like to receive a copy of Andrew's book, you can make a $120 contribution at 1-800-456-5372. If you would like to be part of our conversation this afternoon, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. So let's talk about the Culinary Institute of America. This suddenly really professionalized restaurant cooking in an unprecedented way in this country.
It did. It made major changes in the way chefs were trained. Prior to this time, there had been some culinary schools, but most of them were targeting poor women, and they targeted those who were engaged in the wealthy's homes in terms of cooking and preparation. But with restaurants growing in America, they really needed a trained professional staff, and it was the CIA that really begins to do that.
I think it's fascinating that although most of the students, especially initially, were men, the school, in fact, was founded by two women.
Yes, indeed it was. And those two women made history by creating the CIA and by nurturing it over a long period of time.
How did corporate farming practices start to take hold in America?
I trace corporate farming actually back to the 19th century and the invention of mechanized agriculture. I target as a representative case the McCormick's Reaper, which really makes it possible for large farms to survive and thrive with mechanical means. Prior to the time of McCormick's Reaper, which was really the improved version was available in 1848, all harvesting of small grains was done by hand. You had to bend over, take your sickle, cut a stand of wheat, bundle it together, put it onto a have it collected on a wagon, and the process was very time consuming and very very labor intensive. But with McCormick's Reaper coming along, which was initially horse drawn and later steam powered and subsequently to that diesel powered, you had large combines that could really begin to process grain in thousands of acres, not just 10 acres or 15 acres that a farmer might have.
You know, that phrase corporate farming sort of raises the hackles of a lot of people today. But back then, I would imagine this was a revolution that people thought was going to make food more affordable and in fact, make the food supply more reliable.
It did. It lowered the price of food. Obviously, labor was a major cost in food production. And if you can reduce the amount of labor that you need to harvest food, it means that the food prices are going to drop. And also, what it meant was that large numbers of people could get into farming that would not have been able to before that due to lack of labor. So these conveniences in terms of production made a major difference in how food was produced. In addition to that, while the corporate farm didn't exist until the 1920s, you had many examples of very large farms that might have been family-owned, but they were certainly operating in the same way that a corporate farm would today.
It also made a huge difference when we were able to transport what we grew on these farms all the way across the country.
That's correct. The transportation revolution that goes right along with the mechanization of agriculture and the automation of food processing makes a major difference in terms of American food. The Transcontinental Railroad, which was completed in 1869, made it possible to ship food from California. And within a month or two of the driving of the Golden Spike, food was actually tomatoes and fruits and vegetables were actually being sent from California to the East Coast. When they arrived, they weren't in great shape, but at least you had the principle established that you had a national market, and food was no longer a local, just solely local. And in the 1800, almost every American would have consumed food that would have been raised or grown within a distance of maybe 10 miles or 20 miles of where you lived. By the late 19th century, Americans were buying food from California or from Florida from all over the United States, and it would soon go global with the container ships that were developed in the 20th century.
And, of course, that also meant that if you had the money to pay for it, you could live in a freezing cold place like Maine and potentially eat something fresh through the long months of the winter.
Which wouldn't have been possible prior to all of the changes that have gone on. So while lots of us complain about the need to support local farmers, which I believe very strongly, the benefits of having food grown thousands of miles away means that it's possible to have foods that 200 years ago would not have been possible to consume during wintertime or during the off season.
So we absolutely can't talk about American diets without looking at the history of fast food. I have to tell you, I was fascinated to learn that our reputation as an eat-and-run society is not something that we gained in the 20th century.
Yeah, it predates that. It goes back to the 18th century, and I think it largely is connected with the beginnings of capitalism. It's Ben Franklin that says, time is money, and so you really take a look at that application to our society, and people say, well, why should I spend a lot of time either preparing food or eating food when I could be spending that time getting money or doing something else? And I think that's a basic part of an American culture that's still with us today. It isn't just the fast food industry. It's our whole culture that says speed matters, and the faster things go, the more time or the more money we'll have to do other things.
And if nothing else, we do not linger after we have consumed whatever is on our plates.
You know, it certainly wasn't true in the 18th century and the 19th century based on visitors that reported that Americans ate within 3 minutes, ate all the food on their plate within 3 minutes of the time they were served, and they were gone shortly thereafter from the table. But these are boarding houses, and these are unusual circumstances. And, of course, many Americans then and today, home food would have been very different. You would have consumed food over a much longer period of time, and conversation would have been a very important part of the meal.
So, Andrew, when and where did hamburgers enter the national consciousness?
Hamburgers really started in the late 19th century. The ground beef patty was certainly common among many immigrant groups, but it ended up being associated with Germans, who were the largest single ethnic group to come to America. And they served Hamburg steak. And it is when street vendors begin to have the ability to fry the patties and serve them, but they obviously don't have plates and knives and forks as you would a hamburger steak, so they had to put them in bread. It really is a street food that begins in the Midwest, and within my earliest location of a time was 1894, but within a period of 2 or 3 years, hamburgers are served in cities throughout America, and I found that a surprise, how quickly an innovation could be incorporated into communities all over America if it was a good one.
Did we always dress them the same way we do now?
Oh, no. I mean, I stopped counting at about 1,000, the number of ways that you could add different products into the hamburger to make it that. So I'm sure that there are probably 10,000 ways of doing it. But obviously, some of the more interesting ones are the pineapple hamburger, the Hawaiian hamburger with pineapple in it, all sorts of things that we would not traditionally consider. But those things are sold today. So you do have a diversity that continues, although certainly not the way it was in the early 20th century.
McDonald's is so often a target of people who are really worried about what we're putting into our bodies every day. But there is no denying the influence that it had on hyper-efficient food production methods.
I this is going to sound terrible, but my first trip to McDonald's was in 1956. And it was the most incredible experience of my eating out life up to that time. And so, I mean, it was fast. It was efficient. They were all males inside. They all wore white uniforms. They were militaristic in their movements. And you know, they had a timer there that within 45 seconds, whatever you ordered would be served. Now at that time they only had a relatively small menu of 8 or 9 items, but it was the most impressive thing. It was clean, it was well organized, and I was impressed. And that memory has stuck with me for over 50 years. So it really made a huge difference to a large number of people. The food was inexpensive, and it was quick, and it was easy to get. And I think we forget that when we think about the McDonald's Corporation today, with this 35,000 operations going on around the world. So, yeah, there's certainly problems with the types of foods that are served in fast food, and that we shouldn't we should be concerned about that. But at the same time, we should be concerned about the efficiency and effectiveness of the way they serve food. I think there's a great story there.
Of course, back then, a burger was an ounce and a half, and you got about a half a cup of French fries.
And the French fries were much smaller, and the sodas were much smaller, too. So I think I calculated once that the original caloric value of the McDonald's meal of a burger and small fries and a Coke, and I think it worked out to less than about 600 calories, so it's relatively small. Today, if you tried to get a burger plus a large fry plus a large beverage, you're talking 1,500 calories. So
they had instantly a lot of imitators. There was Taco Bell, there was Burger King, which was named something else first.
Well, a lot of people looked to the McDonald Brothers operation as a model. They just served a lot of food very quickly. The McDonald Brothers were grossing about $1 million a year, which for 1950s was a huge amount of money for any fast food chain. They only had a single store at first, and then they began to franchise. And it was at that point that virtually everybody else that was in the fast food business went to see how they operated and then duplicated their model, frequently using other foods, so tacos for Taco Bell, or even Kentucky Fried Chicken, which existed prior to the time of the McDonald's Brothers franchising their operation. But Kentucky Fried Chicken took the model that McDonald's followed with the architecture and the limitation on food and a whole series of other things that are down there. They followed those things through and carried them out into different areas. So in many ways, the McDonald Brothers had a huge influence far and above just the McDonald's Corporation.
Andrew F. Smith is my guest. He's professor of food studies at the New School University. His new book is called Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. We'll get back to our discussion with Andrew in just a moment. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. If you would like to support KERA, support the show that brings you great, fascinating guests like this one, interesting discussions every single day, Monday through Thursday, you can give us a call now at 1-800-456-5372. Join now by the senior producer who makes the show possible, Jeff Whittington. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We are trying to get to the $200,000 mark in the drive today, by the end of the day today. So we're a few hours away, but we're making great progress. We've heard from so many of you. Thank you so much to folks like, well, specifically to Deidre Watson in DeSoto, Emily Miller in Dallas, and James Wong in Plano. Thank you so much for your contribution. We're still waiting to hear from you, however, my friend and fellow listener. Chris and I listen too. We're not asking you to do anything crazy that we wouldn't do ourselves. We support the station. We listen. So how about your support? 800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can join online as well at kera.org, and you can get a copy of Andrew Smith's new book, Eating History.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can do this as well online at kera.org. You know, Jeff, I think about it sometimes like, you know, we all live in neighborhoods, and sometimes somebody will throw some trash in the middle of the street, and maybe it's not right in front of your house. And you can certainly leave it there and drive past it six times or walk past it and wait for someone else to do it, and chances are eventually someone will. Or, you know, if you consider yourself a good citizen of the neighborhood, often you go out there yourself, even though you didn't put it
just
there.
Just dump your trash next to it.
No, you pick it up because, you know, doing the right thing, you've done something for yourself.
That's
and
right.
For your
yes.
neighbors. It's sort of a similar thing. Not that listening to KERA is like trash in the street, but it is a matter of taking responsibility for this community of radio listeners that we have created here. You're part of that community, so why not be part of the group of individuals that makes it possible and keeps it strong and clean?
1-800-456-5372, online at kera.org. Don't forget, with your $100 or more contribution today, the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas is going to contribute an additional $25. So if you make a $150 contribution, it's like you're contributing $175. And if you make a $25 contribution, it's like you're contributing $250. Thanks very much to the folks at the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas, another local nonprofit, not-for-profit organization, rather, that is supporting KERA with this challenge.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. And again, it just makes your contribution go that much further here. We want to thank folks like Jacob Thias in Carrollton, Megan McCullough in Sherman, Diane Shook in Dallas, also Mark Irons in Rockwall and Lauren Sheehan in Plano. You can join them right now by calling 800-456-5372.
You know, I like to, when I come in here to pitch with Chris, I like to thumb through the book by the guest and just look at the table of contents. We've talked about some of these things already today, but I think fair food might be one of my favorite topics in here. There's also the Cracker Jack snack. There's Fanny Farmer's cookbook. Andrew covers really the waterfront of sort of American, not just American novelty cuisine, but really events and developments in American cuisine, frozen seafood, TV dinners. There's also McDonald's, of course, Julia Child. You know, things that really did have an impact on the stuff that you and I eat every day. And, you know, this is the stuff that we talk about every day. On KERA, things that have an impact on our lives. And if you think that these kinds of conversations are worthwhile, if they're worth your time, then you should subscribe. You should join. You should become a member. You should contribute to help offset the costs of producing these kinds of conversations. And when you do it at the $120 level, we'll throw in a copy of the book, Eating History, with our thanks.
Those of us who work here do everything in our power to make sure that we use your money carefully. It's something that we are always conscious of. It's just part of our culture at this company. We recognize that you work hard for the money that you send us, and we try to work very hard to make that money pay back to you. You hear every single day what's happening with your dollars. You are able to benefit from content that you helped to pay for. The telephone number to join the members of KERA is 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to kera.org if you want a copy of Andrew F. Smith's new book. That's available today at the $120 contribution. So say you make a $120 contribution, that qualifies for the additional $25 from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas. So that's as if you gave $155 to KERA, and you're also receiving a terrific book.
1-800-456-5372. Online at kera.org. You also get entered into that drawing for an overnight stay at the Omni for two with breakfast in Fort Worth. That's going to be drawn during Marketplace today. So don't wait. Call now, 800-456-5372, or pledge online at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here this hour with food historian Andrew F. Smith. His latest book is called Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Stuart in Plano. Hi, Stuart.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead, please.
Well, I was just going to add to your program. I grew up in a small town in Iowa. I'm 62 right now, but it was, and I'm a baby boomer, born in 47. But one thing that I saw happen when I was growing up is when I was a boy there, the average yield of corn and beans was 40 and 60 bushels an acre. And then following that time, which was came from the development of nitrates, which came out of the Germans making bombs in World War II, and the Americans brought it back, the yield on corn today is 200 bushels an acre. That's greatly increased the production of those crops in Iowa and increased the farming size from 180 acres up to 500 acres of farm out there now, too.
Thanks so much for your call. That's a pretty amazing change, Andrew.
There's a huge number of changes that have gone on in agriculture over the past 40 years. In tomatoes, I looked at it, compared with 1960 today, there's only 25% of the land growing tomatoes in America, but it's producing 10 times the number of tomatoes. Now, they may be hard, and they may be not as edible as the original tomatoes were, but the huge increase in production and agriculture is just a fascinating story.
You have a terrific chapter here about Gourmet Magazine, which first started publishing in 1941. Sadly, has just announced it is going out of publication. Tell us about its first audience.
Well, its first audience was intended to be gourmets, people who, because the war had made it impossible to go to Europe for at least those who would have gone to Europe and eaten the food and enjoyed the tourism of the continent. This was a way of vicariously enjoying it. But it was also for Americans who wanted to go to Europe but couldn't do it simply because they didn't have the money. So it really fell into two categories. The entire print industry has serious problems today, but I would have expected Gourmet to survive, and that was somewhat of a surprise to me a few weeks ago when they said that they were ending their print edition.
Yeah. Do you think ultimately it was almost a victim of its success with websites like Epicurious?
Well, I think that was part of it. They claimed that their audience was no longer there, but their subscriptions have done very well. But what had not gone well is simply the advertising, and advertisers move from print media into the Internet, and I think that's the problem that virtually all print magazines and newspapers are going to face.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372, and this time we'll speak with Sid in Arlington. Hello, Sid.
Hello. My question and my comment is this. I worked as a stock boy in a Kroger store in the early 60s, and there was no plastic packaging in the store. It was paper, metal, or glass. And what's been a comment on the role of packaging in food? Because I think it's a big role. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, there's a couple things. It simply is the petrochemical product that's cheaper than the other products. The other thing is the good news from my standpoint. If I drop a plastic bottle, it doesn't break, as in historically would have had it been glass. There are obviously some people with health concerns about the amount of plastic that is directly in contact with food. According to the FDA, however, there's nothing to be worried about, but I guess lots of us are concerned about that.
We'll go back to the phones, and this time it is Ken on the line in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. Is it an American thing, a purely American thing, that we appropriate foods from other cultures and sort of bend them to our will, sort of Americanize them? Or do other cultures do this just about as often as we do? Thank you very much.
Well, thanks.
Well, it's certainly an American trait that's been around for hundreds of years. We are able to take any food and convert it into something quite different than what the original food was. The good examples are, of course, tacos in America, which have very little reference to tacos in Mexico, or pizza in America, which really had relatively little connection with the pizza that originated in Naples. But you look at all these products, and what we've done is we've converted them into that which the mainstream Americans enjoy. Americans, for a lot of reasons, don't like lard, which Mexican cuisine is based on. And if you go into most Mexican restaurants in the United States, they're not going to cook food with lard simply because of the lack of interest and the people who simply don't enjoy the taste of lard-based foods. So, yes, I think we've done that. That said, as you begin to look at every other culture, the same thing is happening there today as well. So if you go to Europe, even French food has outside of France is no longer the same as French food in France. I think that's just a part of human nature.
We have also used food and food culture in this country to try to sort of Americanize new immigrants. Will you talk for a minute about Thanksgiving?
Well, I think Thanksgiving is our national feast. If there's any single day that we have that we celebrate food, it's on that day. And it's usually a family meal with a turkey in the middle of the table and all sorts of accoutrements, depending on where we are. Historically, the story of the pilgrims, which is a wonderful story, which I like very much, has nothing to do with Thanksgiving. and it's one of those myths that was created in the late 19th century. And it was picked up by public schools, and public schools inevitably tried to teach the beginning of America by talking about the Pilgrims. And historically, as we all know, Jamestown was the first English colony, and there were colonies prior to that time European colonies prior to that time that survived. So it's a nice story that sounds good and I like very much, but it simply has nothing to do with history.
And turkey became the food that we promote on Thanksgiving because at the time this holiday was coming into fashion, it was something that most families could actually afford.
That's right, and it's a large amount of food, a large amount of meat is on the turkey, and it's historically one of the lowest costing meats that's available. So in one sense, you could really share that with a lot of people and not cost a lot. So you could bring your family, you could bring your extended family, and you could bring people who didn't have a family into your feast on Thanksgiving. And I think that's one of the wonderful parts of the day.
I know that we're skipping all over the timeline here, but Jeff and I alluded to this a little bit in the break. Will you tell us about why we now have microwave ovens in every kitchen?
Well, microwave ovens really starts off because of the invention of radar, and Americans were experimenting a lot with radar. Mostly, they were given a lot of the inventions by the British, who in 1940 were in deep trouble and needed a lot of help. It just so happens that a number of those people who were experimenting, Spencer Percy being one, was carrying a candy bar in his pocket and ran right in front of a microwave producer, and the candy bar melted. He took one look at that and said, "Whoa, this is interesting." And the next day he brought in some popcorn and put popcorn in front of the microwave generator, and the popcorn popped all over the laboratory. So it really starts off as a military invention. At that time, a company that was manufacturing the radar said, "Well, the war's going to end. We need to have civilian applications on this." And the microwave oven was one of those that came out of World War II.
Looking to the future, you see essentially three possibilities for how our relationship to food might change. Can you talk about those a little bit?
I put down just very briefly at the end, the history's nice, but what does it all mean? And I came up with three different scenarios, one of which is the doomsday scenario, in which the whole thing collapses, our food system collapses due to a whole series of different possible reasons. I don't describe them at great length, but there's all sorts of problems, global warming being one, or a series of diseases or disasters and agriculturally that could cause serious dislocations in the agricultural system that's very tightly connected today. So that was one possible future. The other one was the green future, in which sustainable agriculture becomes the dominant theme in America and the world, and we solve the global warming issues with regard to energy and things of that sort. Another scenario that I took a look at was the corporate future, of which there are a relatively few corporations which begin to control, which even today begin to control American food production and distribution. And that I look at as certainly a clear possibility based on the last 50 years of American food system. And my final one is that we'll just muddle through. So it's likely that we will have all sorts of things that are going to happen. Genetic engineering is likely here to stay. It's likely that we're going to have major problems of one sort or another in our food system. It's likely that sustainable agriculture will certainly increase. And based on current projections, it's likely that corporate control over the food system is going to increase as well.
Andrew F. Smith teaches food studies at the New School University. His latest book is called Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Andrew, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. I want to thank all of you who have listened this hour, and especially I want to thank those of you who have called to support KERA with a contribution at whatever level you think is right. 1-800-456-5372 is the traditional number to do this. And if you want to make a contribution of, now I have to correct my math from last time, if you want to make a contribution of $120, you might choose to receive a thank you gift of Andrew F. Smith's new book, Eating History. And with the additional $25 offered by the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas, in fact, your contribution will be worth $145 to the station, not $155. I think our bad math is sort of a tradition around here.
Membership time. Yeah. Well. Yes. Chris.
And but the folks who are tallying everything, they're much better at this.
That's right. We, and it's not like we just make up what our goals are or anything. There's actually qualified math majors. There are math majors and accounting majors who work here at the company, and they're the ones who say, "Gee, you guys need to raise $600,000 to pay the bills during this drive." So we say, okay, let's do it. So trust us. The math is not left up to us.
Wisely.
We can handle the clock and we can do like the 60-second and 60-minute thing. But anyway, the numbers that we can remember are 800-456-5372. The web address is kera.org. Join us, please. Do your part right now. As Chris said, you can get your very own copy of Eating History, the 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. It's fascinating stuff. And Andrew Smith is always a great guest. It's always fun to have him on. And if you appreciate that, then why not support it? This is your forum. It's your radio station. We heard from a few of you this hour. You call in. You talk to people that we have on the show. And it's always a lot of fun. Even when it's a touchy subject, it's really great to be able to bring you these kinds of conversations. We think it's worth something. We hope that you do, too. The number to call is 800-456-5372.
You know, I say this every time I go out into the community and speak with people, that the reason that KERA is possible is because we have an audience like you that makes it possible with your interest in these subjects. There are a lot of radio stations that are selling commercial advertising that could not get by with an audience, don't have the audience for these kinds of subjects. Not everywhere are there people who want to spend an hour thinking about the history of American food. They would think to themselves, I don't get it. Obviously, you do get it, or you get most of the things that we discuss on the station, and you are interested in them. That interest makes it possible for us to produce this programming. But truthfully, we also couldn't produce the programming without your financial support. More than half of the money it takes to keep the station going comes from individual listeners, people just like you, people just like Jeff and me, who listen and say, yeah, this is worth some of my money. And you decide exactly how much it's worth and what you can afford. That we leave up to you when you call 1-800-456-5372.
And when you do that, you'll be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. Also, K261 CW 100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. No matter where you listen, though, you're getting KERA. You get Think every Monday through Thursday, noon to 2, right here. It's your show. We make it for you. We're asking you to help pay for part of the expenses, not all the expenses, but part of the expenses that come with producing a show, with turning the lights on in a building, with broadcasting, with fixing the headphones and the microphones, with renting space on the tower out in Cedar Hill so that we can get this signal out of this building and into your radio and into your head. And I mean, that's what we're asking you to help pay for. Not all of it, just whatever it's worth to you. A couple hundred dollars a year would be great. The number is 800-456-5372.
You can also go online to kera.org and join good folks like Cody Bloomfield of Dallas, Laura Onsgaro in Dallas, Tom Hendricks in Coppell. You can be the next person. It is a good time to contribute right now because we have people set up to take your call. We are always excited to receive your money. Please don't feel like you can't call us in 3 months if somehow you've come into a little cash. But the membership drives are the times that we sort of organize all of this. And our pledge to you is good. When we raise the $600 that the smart money folks have told us we need to keep going until the next drive, we will quit. And hopefully you have noticed that pattern over the past several membership drives.
$600,000.
And so then we'll stop until the next time we're doing a fundraising drive, and we'll all be delighted. So if you want to see that moment come, why not make your contribution now and get us there that much faster?
The great news, Chris, is that we're almost $180,000 raised, which means that it's Wednesday. We started on Friday with some pitching in the morning. We did some Saturday. We're making fantastic progress. Please join this this rising tide of people who are coming literally out of the woodwork to call and join the station. People from all over the Metroplex are calling. People are from all over the Metroplex are going online to KERA.org, and they're supporting your radio station. They're paying for the fact that you listen to the station. And folks at the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas, they've said, you know what, we'll kick in $25 per donation of $100 or more today, up to $5,000. That's $5,000 more dollars.
That's huge.
That we can use toward what it costs to run this radio station. So please call 800-456-5372. Please go online to KERA.org. Make your pledge now. We're going to have a fascinating conversation. I know it's going to be fascinating.
Gail Collins.
With Gail Collins, the New York Times, in the next hour. She's going to be in town next week. We're going to talk to her about her new book and her work. You're not going to want to miss that. So call right now.
1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can find out at that number about different ways to pay and membership levels. You can find out about thank you gifts. You can also check them out online. They're always available for your perusal at KERA.org. You pick the level that makes sense to you for an annual membership to KERA, and then just pick up the phone or get online. It's that simple. 1-800-456-5372. Thanks.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.